It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob, here with you on Community Radio Station 3CR, and this is a Friday Rave.
Well, happy May Day, people. Even though it's not actually May Day today when I'm recording this, because I'm recording it yesterday, Thursday, but you're hearing it on Friday, so happy May Day, people. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but Melbourne played a significant role in the development of May Day as a International Working People's Day. May Day became recognised as the Workers' Day in 1904 to commemorate the Haymarket protests in Chicago in 86. But what a lot of people don't know is that Victoria is the place where the 8-hour working day first became mandated. And the 8-hour day was celebrated as a public holiday here from 1879. You know, when workers in the US, and Chicago in particular, were fighting for the 8-hour day, the Melbourne 8-hour day themselves, as it was called, they spoke about Melbourne. And it's believed that the 1st of May 86 was chosen by the US Federation of Organized Labor as the date they would have the 8-hour day introduced, at least in part because of its, what do you call it, temporal proximity to our celebrations. Though no doubt the coming of spring and the older May Day traditions held some sway as well. Anyhow, May Day has always been a part of Melbourne workers' history. So when we found out this year that there was not going to be a May Day rally in Melbourne due to the virus pandemic and related laws, well, a few of us were upset. I mean, after all, it looks like the virus has hit Sydney harder than here, and well, they're having a May Day car cavalcade. And I was on a hookup about that the other night, and it's going ahead, and they're having a reasonable belief that the police aren't going to hassle them about it. So we figured we couldn't get enough cars or any support from trade unions, and as it seems, the state of Victoria didn't pay any attention to the fact that protesters at the refugee rally a couple of weeks ago stayed largely in their cars, we may as well exercise our right to exercise and go kill two birds with the one stone and exercise together today on May Day. So, folks, that's where I am. Well, while you're listening to this, I'm actually probably on my way there and setting it up, but it's why I'm not doing a Facebook live stream today. Getting myself down to the 8-hour day monument on Lygon Street. So if you feel like some exercise, then by all means come along and exercise in respectful social distance while celebrating May Day. Exercise your rights. However, I've got to say that judging by the police response to the refugee action, they may not see it as a legitimate thing to do under the rules and may indeed issue fines. But bearing this in mind, and the idea that the fines could be challenged in court anyway, I'd love to think there are some of you who take the risk. Not the risk of catching a virus. Most of you are out and about in public doing the things you do anyway, shopping, working, whatever. And we are advising you maintain physical distance while exercising. We're even providing brollies to help you maintain a physical distance. Nothing says social distance like a bloody metre and a half umbrella. But what I mean is take the risk that police may see things differently and issue the fines anyway. It's a small price compared to the indignities our predecessors paid to begin the work of enshrining workers' rights in law more than a century ago. Excuse me. So that out of the way, you're listening to Community Radio 3CR 855 on your AM dial or through 3CR Digital or via all the W's at 3cr.org.au anywhere in the world. Now, last week I began what I called a mini-series on Australian defence industry, and I promised that today I'd talk a little about what governments are doing to promote the export of military equipment and the associated rise in weapons production here. Now, there's a bit I want to speak about in the issue of the coronavirus laws, or app, as well today, so maybe I'll just talk about the federal government's role and do a roundup of state governments over the next couple of weeks or so. And I'm racing through this because it's a lot to say. The main thing people will be aware of is previous Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's announcement of the establishment of a $4 billion, $3.8 billion Defence Export Facilitation Fund back in January 2018. And at the time, Australia ranked 20 in the world of arms exporters, and Turnbull announced he wanted us to be in the top 10 within a decade. Now, mind you, we're a fifth of the way through that decade, and it seems like we're making inroads, although it's too soon to get current figures, as it was only 2 years ago, and reporting of these things is woefully slow. One of the major initiatives of the federal government I'm going to today was the establishment of the Australian Defence Export Office in April 2018 by then Defence Minister Christopher Pyne. Now, I'm going to make a divergence here, and I'll have a look at what Christopher Pyne has been up to since he retired from government last year. There's way too much to go into comprehensively, but at the very least, let's look at the fact that he is director of no fewer than five advisory firms. I can't call them lobbying firms because, well, apparently, while these companies provide advice and information, Christopher himself can't actually lobby government. For a while yet, because he was a previous minister. In fact, he was preemptively warned by the Attorney General's office last year not to lobby after one of his companies went into bat for a mob called Sabre Astronautics. Now, this crew do tracking software for satellites, and were given $2.7 million worth of Defence Department contracts before Pyne retired from the Defence Ministry. His firm for this project is called GC Advisory, who also acts for the IT company known as the Ethan Group, that were awarded $50 million in defence contracts whilst Pyne was either Defence Minister or prior to that Minister for Defence Industry. But not to worry, Chris had already been warned of the potential illegality of his lobbying for arms dealers when he joined EY, excuse me, at a time when they were trying to grow their defence business, so he's found a workaround. You see, while Pyne is banned from lobbying, his former Chief of Staff as Defence Minister, Andrew Howard, who is now Pyne's partner in GC Advisory, he's not banned from lobbying, so it's all good then. Pyne, I've got to say, by the way, also holds a position with the University of South Australia as industry professor, a role which saw him recently establishing a working group this week, I think, of military and corporate and government reps to find a way to leverage the corona pandemic to boost Australia's military industry. Yeah, he believes in the old saying that a crisis is also an opportunity, doesn't he? Well, that was just a divergence. I was saying that Christopher Pyne opened the Defence Export Office in 2018 to help foster a whole-of-government approach towards facilitating arms sales. Pyne then announced that David Johnson, a former Defence Minister in the Abbott government, had been appointed as Australia's first Defence Export Advocate. Now, Johnson's job is twofold. Firstly, to travel the world pimping out Australian industry to the international arms market, and to liaise between government and industry to clear barriers in the way of defence production and export. Actually, let me read it direct from the Defence Export Office mission statement. First, strengthen the partnership between the Australian government and industry to pursue defence export opportunities. Sustain Australia's defence industrial capabilities across peaks and troughs in the domestic market. To enable greater innovation and productivity in Australia's defence industry to deliver world-leading defence capabilities. To maintain the capability edge of the Australian Defence Force and leverage defence capability development for export opportunities. And finally, to grow Australia's defence industry to become a top 10 global defence exporter. So how are they doing this? Well, how are they doing it? Throwing money at it for a start. Now, just give you an indication of some of the money. Some of the grants that are available through the Defence Export Office website are capability improvement grants of up to 150K, Defence Global Competitive Grants up to 150K. You know, they've got one called the New Air Combat Capability Industry Support Program Grants, $1 million. The US-Australia International Multidisciplinary University Research Initiatives, OSMURI, I spoke about them last year, of $1 million per year. And the Sovereign Industrial Capability Priority Grant of up to $1 million. Now, sorry, I'm sitting at home on my front porch here or at someone else's home on the front porch flicking through phones and computers when I'm talking to you. Sorry, it's a bit scatty. It's okay to say that, but let's look at some of the recipients. I haven't got time. Just to the last program, the Sovereign Industrial Capability Priority Grant, that this year have included $1 million to a Melbourne mob out at Sunshine called Infinite Engineering that do all kinds of metal fabrication. They're a part manufacturer. I can't find out just exactly yet what they're building for who. For the military, it was only announced this week. As soon as I find out, I will let you know. The same goes for a machinery factory in Clayton called Aerospac that got $400,000. In Bayswater, the Australian arm of a Swiss-based global defence company, RUAG, picked up a cool million to help them modernise their factory. Now, this is a Swiss-based multinational company, and we're giving them $1 million to help them modernise their factory to make stuff that we can then buy off them. This is ridiculous. In Australia, this will make all manner of high-precision bits and bobs of defence, but I believe they manufacture parts for the F-35 in the undercarriage. Can't verify that just yet. Now, here's an interesting one. An enterprise called the Smart Think Australia, which is a collaboration between the Singaporean and, government and the Australian Government's Defence Materials Technology Centre, DMTC. The Smart Think is based at Deakin Uni down in Geelong and have just received $200,000 for new equipment. I believe they're working on ballistic armour down there, possibly even helmets. Over in the hills, in a little place called Selby that I used to drive past every day without realising, is a mob called Aquatero, who make ballistic clothing and weapons mounting systems and the like. They've just received $370,000 to bring their ammunition storage facilities up to Australian standard. Now, they're just all the ones in Victoria. The same is replicated all around the country. And they're just the ones under the Sovereign Industrial Capability Priority Grant. I could do shows and shows and shows just listing through who's got what. Maybe that's an idea. I'll put one together for when I can't get a show up. They can just put it up. Anyway, it's not only the money. The Centre for Defence Industry Capability also provides advisors to help businesses get into the defence industry. And they're a one-stop online shop that not only let you know of opportunities as they arise, all the tenders there, but they match up your capability with prime contractors. They actually encourage people who aren't involved in defence industry to list their capabilities so that they can connect them up in the defence industry. They can connect you up with global supply chains. They can organise your participation in international arms shows. In fact, they bend over backwards to do anything they can to get you involved in the industry. Oh, and they'll also hook you up with other areas of both federal and state governments that order further assistance for exporters. So there's a lot going on. And there's a lot going on this week in the rest of the Friday Rave world as well. So I'll just finish here because there's non-industry, non-arms industry anyway, related things I want to talk about. But before closing this little bit off, I want to say that what I've just outlined are the overt measures. There's a lot more besides, and that includes, fundamentally, Australia's bipartisan support of neoliberalism. There are many ways that this assists the military industry, but just one I'll touch on here is education. Now, I was just talking about Pyne, so it's salient to note that both Pyne and Australia's other defence minister, charged with building Australia's defence exports, Kim Beazley, not affectionately known as Bomber, Kim Bomber Beazley, they also both served as education ministers. And both of them put a great deal of energy into deregulating Australia's tertiary education sector and, of course, reducing their funding and pulling apart student organisations. Now, this has played a big part in today's universities' need to seek corporate support to shore up funding shortfalls, which inevitably means that companies that have benefited from the public purse through the government's grants to industries and, you know, arms companies, let's just call them what they are, companies that have benefited from the public purse through their grants put their money into tax-deductible partnerships with universities and double up by getting free research facilities built and maintained by the public purse and the students who study there, supported by the public purse, though less and less, to do their research. The resultant products, which they can then sell back to the government, that is, the public purse. But more on universities' role in another show. And I guess what I'm talking about here, neoliberalism, which is, you know, socialism for the rich and capitalism for the rest of us. Anyhow, you're listening to Community Radio, 3CR 855 on your AM dial via 3CR Digital or through the web at 3cr.org.au. Well, I can't really go through this week without mentioning the ankle bracelet. Sorry, the COVID-safe tracing app. I was speaking on Uprise Radio here on 3CR on Wednesday evening, which is a good show every second Wednesday, with James and Jackson at 5:30. And we were joined by David Parrish from Digital Rights Watch to talk about the app. You can listen back through the 3CR website. Now, I'm absolutely bemused by the number of people who have already downloaded this app, not the people in the general community, because frankly, the 2.5 million who have done so far, isn't that huge? And it's actually given me some hope that we're not as neighbourhood watch as we sometimes seems to be. What distresses me is the number of my social media contacts, who not only post that they've downloaded it, but are urging others to as well. Now, many are using the argument that we, as social activists, have a responsibility to do what we can, to put aside our own concerns and our what's best for us, and work socially together to beat the virus. Well, bugger me. You've heard, I assume, all the issues with privacy about the app. All the laws that impinge on it, all the ways that it's going to be the data can be accessed by US administration. By the way, that it's against the law to actually have an app on your phone which is not able to be decrypted at the request of the Australian government. So that, you know, the app, if it's as secure and de-encryptable as the Australian government says it is actually an illegal app. So they're shooting themselves in the foot there. But I'm not going to go into all the privacy and data security implications here because I haven't got time. But I do want to talk about other aspects of the app. So if you want to know about the data and security issues, by the way, go to digitalrightswatch.org.au and read their take on it. They're the best. For all digital rights, they are the best people to check out. digitalrightswatch.org.au. I've had Tim from that organisation on the show a couple of times, and I probably will again. But anyway, I'm not going to talk about it. I want to talk about other aspects of the app. First and foremost is the fact that it's ineffective. It plain and simply does not work for the task it's ostensibly designed to do. For a start, it doesn't work properly on iPhones. And that's to do with it needing to connect in the background with other devices, which iPhone's iOS operating system does not allow third-party apps to do. Now, they say it's for privacy measures, it's probably commercial measures. Okay, the government reckons that Apple are looking into fixing that, but when? Even on Android, you apparently need to have it on. And let's assume that many of the early uptakers are not the most tech-savvy people in the community. You know, let's just assume that for it to work. So if you have an Android phone, and if you keep your app on, and you decide, you know, if you decide to flout the social distancing regulations and be within 1.5 metres of a stranger for more than 15 continuous minutes, and if that stranger has an Android phone with the app installed and turned on, and if they take a test, and if they are confirmed positive, and if they decide to upload the data, and if the health department are efficient enough to call you on time, and if the 15-minute contact with that person happened at the time when they were contagious, and if you manage to get a test, and if you are confirmed positive, and if you are responsible with that information and both uploaded to your data, and if you're in a lifestyle and economic situation where you could quarantine yourself even if you wanted to, and if you actually do, then and only then, if all these if conditions are met, would there be a chance, not a definite, but a chance, that your downloading of the COVID-safe app actually led to a reduced chance of spreading the virus? So with all these ifs being a potential break in the effectiveness of the data, in the effectiveness of the app, why is the Australian government hinging the lifting of restrictions on a high uptake of it? Well, there are two possible answers to that. Well, three, if you consider the one that the government is actually that bloody stupid and it can't see the problems for itself. But the main two are, A, they have ulterior motives for pushing the use of the app. Possible, and a lot of people are prescribing to this, but I don't really like the conspiracy. I think it's more likely that, B, they found themselves in a knee-jerk reaction to the virus that they now need to mitigate. And the app is a way of being seen to be doing something, anything, to give them an opportunity to lift the ridiculous, inconsistent regulations they've put in place without having to admit that they're fucked up. Now, don't get me wrong. While I don't like conspiracies, you know, that it's all another way to track us, I've no doubt that there are those that see the possibilities of that use of COVIDSafe and are keen to help get it implemented for that purpose. But really, I think this is a case of a government well and truly out of its depth and clutching at anything they can do to be seen to be dealing with things. By insisting on a high uptake of the app to begin the easing of the restrictions, they can then transfer the blame of the economic and social disasters of the regulations from themselves to the public. And look, I'm not just talking about the economic, you know, governments and industry losing money over this. There are social disasters as well. There's a whole, we don't know the effect of keeping young children at home alone without social interaction. And we don't know the numbers, but we're hearing that domestic violence reporting has gone through the roof. And we don't know. We don't know. But there are social impacts as well as the economic ones. Now, the government morally shaming the Australian people for not wanting to look out for each other and using that as a reason to keep harsh rules in place on the one hand, or alternatively, claiming that the app was the best way they could do things in a situation where the Australian people wanting restriction lifted, its best use to the Australian government is a way to abrogate their responsibility, either way. Now, just as an aside, and Friday rave is nothing as if not constant asides, when I diss the regulations, it's not because I think we should live life as normal. But the regs in place are so inconsistent in who can do what and where and when that it makes all the regs ultimately useless and meaningless. Basically, the regs and the app are based on the goodwill of the people anyway. So why not just trust the people and not hold arbitrary sticks over our heads? Why is it that, for example, people can work in non-essential industry, in fact, are encouraged to do so, while people sitting in cars or maintaining physical distance in a protest are handed out fines or worse, organisers arrested for incitement? Now, as any good parent, teacher or manager knows, if you try to enforce inconsistent rules and only bluster when questioned as to why the rules are in place, none of your rules will be followed. But still, people are advocating its use, the use of the app. I've had good people, don't get me wrong, I like these folks and think they're generally quite intelligent and on the mark on most issues. Good people, either advocating the use of the app or humbugging objections to it. Now, the first argument is usually along the lines of the ACTU and can be generally put as, they're tracking us anyway. It's not as if this app will give them any data they can't already get now. Well, my answer to that is yes, we're being tracked, and the tracking is a form of abuse. But just because you're being abused does not generally mean that we're expected to legitimise the abuse and, you know, sign up for more anyway, I've got to say. It's as if we're expecting a victim of domestic violence to say, he's hitting me anyway, or an Indigenous person, or an African kid to say, racism is inherent in the system. A bit more won't make that much difference. It is a fallacious argument. That's all there is to it. And it's being made largely by people who don't really believe that they're being tracked by the state is that big a deal. Because, and here's the next bit, they've got nothing to hide. And that next argument, those in favour of the app use, it's the I've got nothing to hide. You know, you've heard it before on all kinds of privacy issues, and I've spoken about it before. And I've got a couple of problems with that. Firstly, it implies that anyone with something to hide is by definition bad and somehow deserves to be tracked. But you know, many of us actually do have something to hide, not because it's bad, but because either it's harmless yet against the law for some reason, or it's got to do with political campaigning and the exposing of corruption in high places. Now, I'm sick to bloody death of the I've got nothing to hide brigade smug implication that if we were good, we shouldn't be worried about it. Indeed, you know, that's probably a big part of the reason that our mate Julian gets so little support from the left community. Julian had the date of his trial put back this week, by the way. We haven't got a new date yet, but probably more on that next week. The trouble with the I've got nothing to hide mentality is that if you follow through with the logic, if everyone who thinks they've got nothing to hide opts into a surveillance system, then by definition, those who don't must have something to hide. And in a state where police have power to demand access to our phones, the very absence of the app may well trigger suspicion, or not trigger suspicion, they've already got suspicions, because that's why they've demanded access to our phones, it might confirm their suspicions. So if you're thinking of opting in, or if you already have, please either don't or opt right back out again, as an act of solidarity. As an act of solidarity with those of us who may have something to hide. You know, it reminds me something a bloke I was related to by marriage, in fact, once said to me, I don't need a union because I've got no problems. My boss is a good bloke. A couple of years later, he was on the phone wanting help, outraged that the union wouldn't support him. Not downloading the app is in fact a kind of collective prophylactic against the disease of surveillance, just like joining a union is a kind of collective prophylactic against workplace abuse. I'm running out of time, but I also want to make the point about the so-called voluntary nature of the app, and that while it's not mandatory, it's open to coercion. Already I'm aware of one young retail worker who has been told she will only get her next shift if she installs the app. She doesn't want to, but she really needs the work. Almost like an involuntary but economically enforced conscription. And that's what we're getting to. How many people are now going to be saying, I need to work, I'll get the app? How many teachers are going to be forced to have it? And when school resumes, when they open the shops, won't it be a matter of you can get the shift if you have the app? It's all for the good of the nation. And on that note, I'm out of here. I'm on my way, as you're hearing me, down to the 8-hour monument to do some exercise. I hope you can join me. If not, I'll talk at you next week. My name's been Jacob. This has been a Friday Rave.